me. But my name's Gary Hogan. I'm the leader of the Technology and Learning Research Group, which is, has the acronym of TALLR. And that we're all trying to aspire to be TALLR, not only in our approaches to education, but somewhere. Anyway, look, it's a real privilege today to have Stephen come talk to us. He truly is a world of identity in information and communication technologies. I did actually ask Stephen just before this how many keynote talks he has done, and he's actually done 217. I'm not sure if this is the 18th one, but he has done 217, which is a hell of a lot more than I've done. I'm actually longer than I've done. And he's also the keynote speaker at Ed Media this year, which is in Hawaii. So there's going to be a little sort of fan club from UOW for Stephen. His main research area is to do with personal learning environments and connectivism. And he's going to be talking about ways of using that today. And he described it as an emerging theory of learning. So it's pretty exciting to have Stephen here. The only question I have, Stephen, was that on his website, for his CV, it said standard biography. So I was just wondering, maybe there's a non-standard one around that for all sorts of different audiences. But yeah, we just got the standard one. So I'd like to introduce Stephen Downs.
Hi everyone, I hope the mic's working okay, and there are non-standard biographies, and no, you can't see them. Thanks so much for coming out. I really appreciate you coming out on our noon hour on a Friday on what to me is a very warm and muggy day when you can be in nice air. Well, I guess this is air conditioned. This is air conditioned for you, but less so for me.
You keep talking, I'll just take them off.
Oh, okay. You're adjusting stuff. Okay. So I want to keep this really informal. Well, that's volume control. Now I need to be careful. This is my brand new microphone. I'm very proud of my new microphone, but I'm still working on echo cancellation and things like that. So, but anyhow, yeah. If you're recording, please feel free to record. If you're videoing. See, John's in the front row videoing. Please feel free to do that as well. As I go through this, we've got an hour. I've got about 4 hours worth of material. So feel free to slow me down and ask questions and guide this and direct this in any way you want. I'd be more than happy to abandon the presentation and pursue whatever line of inquiry you're interested in. So don't feel that we need to follow the plan necessarily. So having said that, what is the plan? Like I said, I've probably got too much material, but it's one of these things where you have an overly ambitious title, right? And if we go back to the title here, We go back to the connectivist learning and the personal learning environment. And there was also stuff in the outline about learning design and all of that. So very ambitious project. Here's the plan, overall, talking about the connectivist learning model, what personal learning looks like. I want to talk a little bit. I want to show you the connectivist online course and talk a bit about that, and then wrap up by going back to the theory of free learning and some thoughts on designing connectivist learning. Like I said, very ambitious. I'm assuming I'm talking mostly to an audience of people who are designers, educational designers or program coordinators or things like that. If I'm wrong, correct me. So I'm sort of tailoring my remarks in that direction, keeping in mind that design and educational design is almost a bit antithetical to the sort of approach that I like to take in online learning, but we'll deal with that as we go along. How does that sound so far? Okay, nobody's left yet. I'm way ahead of where I was this time. Never mind. All right, where I want to begin with just what I think about learning. As I say, what I think about learning. I always like to be careful to say, I don't come here pronouncing truth or anything like that. I come here representing things as I see it, based on the evidence that I've encountered over time. And so when I say this is what I think learning is, I mean quite literally, this is what I think learning is. But I think it's well supported in literature. I think it's well supported in evidence. And here's how I would phrase it. First of all, learning is to be organized in a certain way. And I mean that quite literally. I mean, when I say to be organized in a certain way, what I mean is to have a certain neural structure, to have a certain set of connections in the brain. But secondly, knowing is like recognizing. It's not simply the case that knowing is to be organized in a certain way, but knowing is to be recognized as being organized in that way. And I know that sounds kind of bizarre and weird and strange, but what I'm trying to do here is contrast this picture of learning with a picture of learning where to learn is to acquire a certain set of facts, or to learn is to have sentences in the brain. And there are really serious theorists out there, people like Polishin and Fodor and others, who actually represent learning as like sentences in the brain. And you learn, you acquire these sentences. You learn, you construct these generalizations. And I'm trying to push away from that picture. So learning is to be organized. Learning is very much to grow and develop in a certain way. Which leads us to something like a definition of connectivism. And this definition is something like the theory that knowledge and learning can be described using network principles. I'll talk a bit about network principles, not nearly as much as I would like in this talk, but I'll talk about them. And therefore, as I said, learning is not to acquire facts, but rather to develop or to grow into that certain network configuration. So, how do networks grow? Networks grow based on principles of association. Basically, what happens when networks grow is connections are formed between entities. In the brain, connections are formed between neurons. In society at large, connections are formed between people. In the great outdoors, described by Duncan J. Watt, connections are formed between crickets. Connections can form among all kinds of things. So I'll talk about neurons, I'll talk about society, but keep in mind, those are metaphors. When I'm talking about networks, I'm talking about something that is more general here, more underlying. It's more abstract. Now, I need to be careful when I talk like that, though. So, how do connections form between neurons? I identify four major ways. This list is probably not exhaustive, but it's pretty representative. Simple Hebbian associationism. This is formulated by Donald O. Hebb in 1947. If two neurons fire at the same time, two neurons are not firing at the same time, a connection forms between them. It's simple similarity. The second form of connection formation is accident, proximity. Two neurons are near each other, a connection forms between them. Two people live next door to each other, they get to talking, you know, accident. A third way is known technically as back propagation. We know it more familiarly, I hate that word, as trial and error. You have an experience, you represent that a certain way in your own mind, in other words, you grow some connections. That causes you to create an action, to take an action, you burn yourself, you reorganize those connections. In the computer science known as connectionism, back propagation is designed as a means of training neural networks in computer science. And then fourth, Boltzmann learning. Boltzmann learning is a type of association where you look at the network as a whole and experience comes into that network and then it starts, you know, signals flying back and forth and connections forming and so on. And then over time, the network will settle into a stable configuration, a lot like a pond will settle into a stable configuration after you drop a rock into it. So there's a set of mechanisms around settling that describe association, formation of connections in this way. I spent a lot longer on this slide than I wanted to, but it's an important slide because, again, how people learn, understanding that people learn through association rather than through acquisition of facts is a fundamental tenet of connectivism. So, what does that mean practically? If you take those principles of association, you get a very simple, basic, ridiculous learning theory. So much so I don't even like to call it a theory. I deny that it's a theory, but it's pretty common sense, I think. And it's a theory that we know. To teach is to model and to demonstrate, not to tell. Now there's a telling aspect to it. Here I am telling, right? So, but the teaching part isn't in the telling. The teaching part is in the modeling and the demonstrating. To learn is to practice and reflect. And both of these, the modeling and demonstrating, the practicing and reflecting, are, I want to say best accommodated, although I'm always wary of the word best, but they both imply participation in a community of practice. I don't like the word community, I don't like the word practice, but I need something to get across what I'm trying to talk about there. So we'll use the term community of practice kind of tentatively. So what happens? You have roles in this community of practice. You have the expert practitioner, the person who presumably knows what they're doing. What their job is, what their role is to perform their work, to do their work in an open and transparent manner. That's how I'm, if you will, teaching here. What I'm doing here is not getting up and telling you things, but I'm practicing what I do in an open and transparent manner. Somebody said to me yesterday, oh, you learn by talking. And I said, yes, that's exactly right. I learn by talking. I come and I give a talk. This is me learning. You are just here. Nothing personal. You know, other people learn in different ways, but again, to do it openly and transparently is to model and demonstrate, to give examples for people to practice. And so we have the role of the learner. The role of the learner is to attach him or herself to this community, to this network, and to begin to interact, to communicate with other people, to observe what people do in this network, to observe physicists doing physics, silviculturalists doing forestry, doctors doing doctoring, etc. And to emulate successful practice and to reflect on that, to engage in a dialogue and a discussion, to be cognizant of what that practice is and what is leading to success according to their perception, their understanding, their point of view. So here's a neat little diagram of the connectivist learning model. And again, it's too simple, too old, too, you know, like, so I shouldn't even call this the connectivist learning model. It's learning pretty much as we've known about it for many years, with, you know, prior to being distracted by a lot of other things. So the model, basically now, We can look at the four elements. First element is modeling. The question is how to actually represent models, how to actually create conceptual frameworks, how to actually present what it is that we know. And there's an awful lot of, you know, just mechanisms that we can put into place as means of, if you will, representing our knowledge. The wiki, the concept map, Gliffy, which is a real nice graphics website, reference frameworks, all of that sort of thing. Things that model our knowledge, keeping in mind that these are models and not knowledge. That was my master's thesis. If you can believe it, yeah, an entire 320 pages on that one point. I'll never do that again. Demonstrating again, you see this a lot online, reference examples, code libraries, image samples. A guy called Jerry Pournelle, who's a science fiction writer, used to write a column in Byte magazine, I don't think Byte even exists anymore, called Chaos Manor. And basically what it was is Jerry Pournelle gets a new piece of software or a new piece of technology, and he plays with it, and he describes what his thinking was as he tried to make this thing work. And it was a fascinating insight because you could see his mind working. So he wasn't writing about the software, he was writing about his understanding of the software. Wonderful example of that sort of process. Practice. There's all kinds of ways of practicing. You probably know them better than I do. There's scaffolded practices, there's game interfaces, there's sandboxes, etc., etc. Practice is key to learning. What was the phrase? Something like interaction is breathing for the brain. The idea here, nah, that's off topic. That should fit together somehow. Nah. Anyhow, you know what I mean here. I'm not going to learn this. And then finally, reflection. Reflection on the practice, reflection on the success of the practice. Because simply, and anyone who's tried to learn a skill knows this, right? You can't just practice the skill. You have to correct yourself. I learned how to play darts, and I spent many, many years learning how to play darts badly. No, actually, that's not true. I learned to play quite well, but you have to not simply practice throwing the dart. You have to reflect on what is it about that throw that is making the dart go there instead of there. And you need to practice against, well, in darts, against better dart players. And you watch what they're doing, and you try to do what they're doing, and their run goes beautifully like that, and your run goes, and you want to understand why. You need to analyze that performance as well as just perform that performance. And then there are the elements that run through this, the elements that unify modeling, demonstrating, practice, and reflection. Elements of choice, identity, and creativity. And again here, and I'll come back to this, a central part of this model is that it's a model that is being pursued and engaged in by the learner at the learner's own direction for the learner's own benefit. So, now we move into some picture slides. How does this translate? That's the theory, and I know it's a cardinal rule, never begin with the theory, but I wanted to begin with the theory because I want the practice to make sense. So the way this rolls out to the learner looks something like this. It's a world of free learning resources. It's a world of all kinds of content that has been created by all kinds of practitioners. The idea here now is you're engaging in this community. This community is flooded and filled with these learning resources. It's a world of user-generated content. Content generated not just by content creators or publishers, but by practitioners who are being open in their practice, by learners who are engaged in reflective processes, and as part of that process, creating content of their own. It's a model where there are connections on connections on connections. Connections at the hardware layer, connections at the software layer, connections at the personal and the social layer, where we are creating multiple networks of interaction. You know, and again, this is one of these things. I'm doing a 15-second slide on this. I could do an entire talk on the multiple networks that actually form the internet. It's immersive learning. It's putting yourself into that community in an authentic way. I learned a lot about what I know about internet technology by taking part in an online community that was based around a multi-user dungeon. A Dungeons and Dragons game online. And people today are learning the same sort of lessons playing World of Warcraft or EVE Online or other games like that. It's quite literally immersion into these communities. And as time goes by, we will see more and more these communities become more and more authentic, more and more real, more and more ways in which we control systems in society and contribute to society. It's new roles, it's roles for students, not just as consumers of learning, but as creators of learning as they exchange interactions back and forth with each other. It's new roles for teachers, not as broadcasters of learning, but as coaches and mentors. But most important, I don't even like coaches and mentors because it implies this, you know, this I'm up here, you're down there, and that isn't the model. The model is, you know, somebody who's more expert, somebody who's less expert, but the interaction is, if you will, and I need to couch this carefully, an interaction between equals. For the rest of us, for society as a whole, this model puts on us a responsibility to be teachers, to not simply be indifferent, non-participating entities in society, but to actually take an active role in whatever job that we have as passing on the knowledge and the skills involved in that role. And that means everybody. And, you know, again, just as an aside, a lot of disciplines have done this forever. Plumbers, auto mechanics. I mean, people learned auto mechanics in the garage because they were into cars when they were kids. And so, and we're going to see, because of the increase in communications technology, this applied to more and more and more disciplines. Learning is a network phenomenon. Learning as being in the network, learning as being a part of the network, learning as creating a network in oneself. The actual process, the placement of oneself in this network is a process of aggregation, remixing, repurposing, and feed forward. And this is, as I sometimes say, be the node. This is the role that the learner, the student, the practitioner has to aggregate, to observe, to watch the modeling and the demonstration, to bring in this content, but not to simply absorb it, but now to begin to work with it, to mix it with content and communications from other people, to repurpose it, to put it into their own words, to adapt it to their own personal frame of reference or their own personal worldview. And then, most importantly, to pass this on, because they're not simple recipients, they are part of a network. And what they learn becomes what they teach. And from a technological point of view, a personal learning center, a model of learning where you, the learner, are at the center of, well, some people have been calling it a personal learning network, but the idea here is that you are at the center and resources and connections are all around you. If you picture a network in your head, you can picture a whole bunch of nodes and a whole bunch of connections between the nodes. Take the perspective or point of view of one of those nodes. And so there you are, you're sitting there in that network, and you've got connections stretching out all around you. That is your position, your role as a teacher. That is your position or your role as a learner. And that leads us to the Connectivism and Connective Knowledge course that George Siemens and I offered last fall. That course was built basically on the model that I've just described. It was built on the model of learning as a network phenomenon. It was built on the model of yeah. Sorry, you two are just killing me.
We just said some amazing brain
words. Okay. Sorry, it's just, if you were anywhere else in the room, it wouldn't be a problem, but you're right at eye level. Sometimes I get thrown off. That happens. It's okay. Don't worry about it. So anyhow, what George and I did, we set up this course. We weren't really keen on it being a course, and I really prefer to think of these things as ongoing rather than courses, but George works for a university, and so there had to be a start, had to be an end, etc. But the structure of the course, the idea here is that we wanted individuals participating in the course to think of themselves as nodes in this connectivist network. This is what the course looked like. This is the course structure. And it doesn't look like your typical course structure, even though in the Connectivist course we had, you know, 12 weekly modules or units, etc. What this is describing here, and of course you can't read the print, is all the different components of the course and how they were connected to each other. And what we wanted to do is to not put everybody into the same technological environment, to not put everybody into the same process, the same mold. So, to this point, I would say the Connectivism course is the best example of Connectivism as a learning theory. So it was a 12-week course, had a lot of ordinary stuff you would expect from courses. So from the perspective of administrators who had to be satisfied, it walked, it talked like a course. From the perspective of people in the course, it looked very different. So one of the things that we did is we made this an open course. We're not sure if that was a mistake or not yet. As you can see from the slide, we made it an open course. 2,200 people signed up. Of those, something like 22 of them paid tuition, which made it okay for the University of Manitoba. That paid the cost. And so the rest of the 2,200 people were able to follow along. And we didn't just open up the course materials the way MIT's open courseware does, and this was a very deliberate policy. We said, and we represented this, what MIT did for course content, we were doing for course delivery. And so we were deliberately opening up the course delivery as well as the course content, which is how we ended up with 2,200 people actually signing up. And so now all of a sudden you've got this huge logistical problem, but the thing is, the model was intended to support this kind of problem. So, as I said, it was offered through the University of Manitoba, 12 weeks long, certificate course. The people who signed up and paid tuition got credit. The people who didn't sign up and pay tuition didn't get credit, although we had one person who signed up, did not pay tuition, but got credit from their own institution. So it also kind of opened up assessment and offered us an interesting model for assessment, right? One course, right? Open course, assessment, 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 different assessment based on the same course material, based on either course standards or local institutional standards. That's something that we want to explore more in the future. So the course was about Connectivism and was offered in a Connectivist model. And so at its heart, Connectivism is the thesis that knowledge is distributed across a network of connections, and consequently our course became a network of connections. So here are the course components that George and I set up. First of all, a wiki. The idea of the wiki was to plan the course. The theory was, we would put the wiki up, and then we, along with all the potential students in the course, would create the course. The practice was George and I created the course. It works out that way sometimes. Then we had, as I said, the open enrollment. We had a sign up, and people were able to sign up. And we advertised the course on, well, George advertised it on his blog. I put it in my newsletter. That was the extent of the advertising. And then in the course wiki, for each of the 12 weeks, we set up the basic structure of the course. So we had readings, George and I each created some stuff, but also, and more significantly, the content of the course was mostly created by linking to free content that was out there on the internet. So, you know, I'm just reading off the screen here, little boxes, globalization, and networked individual. That's an article out there that we linked to. What is the unique idea in Connectivism, etc., etc. We didn't take content and put it into the course. We took the course and linked to content. And you probably ask, well, what happens if the content goes away? Well, yeah, some of the content actually did go away on us. And so then we linked to different content, because it didn't matter whether it's this exact content. It's just we wanted a representative kind of content. And as I go on, you'll see how little a problem this was. Then we set up a blog. This is a WordPress blog that was set up on the University of Manitoba servers. Both George and I contributed to this blog, offering our personal reflections on how the course was going. And then we set up a Moodle forum. The Moodle forum was for the people who liked forums. Me, I'm not really big on forums. And I found the forum kind of, well, 2,200 people, threaded discussion forum, bad mix. And what the thing with a threaded discussion forum is, you know, everybody sees everything. And so you get people who try to monopolize the space. And we had that. And they got very upset with George and I, especially with me, because my response was to urge people to leave the discussion area and go elsewhere. And they were very unhappy that I was telling people to do that, and they thought that I was undermining them in the discussion forum. So it was all very ironical. But a lot of people used the forums. The forums were used from beginning to the end of the course, but you know, it was a big spike of usage at the start, and then it trailed off significantly. But that was deliberate. That's what I wanted to see happen. We also set up a PageFlight site, and what's happening here, and this is the first instance of this, the course, like the content, was not located in a single place. The course was distributed across the internet, which means that there were elements of the course that were not on the University of Manitoba server. Now, because of that, that made keeping track of things a bit hard, so we aggregated these course components using RSS. And one place we aggregated was into this PageFlight site. Then we had online discussions. We had an Illuminate discussion on Wednesday. We had a license for 200 users, and Illuminate said they'd extend the license if we needed it. We didn't need it. We never broke more than 200 people at once, but we did have to add a second Illuminate discussion Wednesday evenings for the people in Australia who complained vehemently about having to go online at 2 a.m. So thank you, people. You created who knows how many extra hours of work for me, because I was not planning on a second late night session. For me in New Brunswick, it was a late night session. I was not counting on that. The Illuminate discussions were pretty good, and they were well attended again throughout the course. We also, on Fridays, did a Ustream session. What we did here is George and I, and in conjunction with Dave Cormier and Jeff Lebeau from EdTech Talk, we all got together on Skype. And we had a Skype conversation, and then Dave and Jeff took that Skype conversation and streamed it into a Ustream feed, and that went out as a live feed. It didn't work as well as we would have liked. We had Ustream bandwidth issues. Ustream, great idea, not quite ready for prime time. But it would have worked beautifully except for the bandwidth issues. A few times we had to go back to Illuminate, even on the Fridays. But you know, in the future, I think we'll probably be able to stream these things on Ustream or something similar in the future. Twitter, there was a Twitter tag, and CCK08, and it was a whole world of Twitter discussions that took place around the course. I missed a lot of them, but I did try to follow the Twitter just by doing the search on the tag, right? And so I was able to follow some of that, but there was this whole back channel happening on Twitter. And of course, we advertised the tag so that people would take part in that back channel. Then I set up my prototype personal learning environment software called Grasshopper, and this created a core element of the course. And we just talked to you briefly about Grasshopper, very briefly. The idea of Grasshopper is that it's a personal learning environment. This, for those of you who haven't seen, is the paradigm diagram of a personal learning environment. That's you at the center, Remember, you're the node in the network, and then you're connected to all of these resources that are in all of these different places online. That's what Grasshopper does. It acts as your central connection to everything else online. So here's another diagram of the same thing, and it's a bit much to talk about in the 15 seconds I have for this slide, but the idea here is, again, it's a system that helps you aggregate, remix, repurpose, and feed forward. So if you are acting as the node in the network, this is software that helps you act as that node. So Grasshopper is intended to be a personal site, but you can also have other people leave comments and do things on the site. So there's a login and all of that sort of stuff. And the idea here is that when people log in to your Grasshopper site, they can sign up for your newsletter. And that's how I set that up. That's also what I do on my personal website. Same technology. You go to my website, downs.ca. If you register, you can sign up for my newsletter. So here's the newsletter subscription page, and you just check off the boxes for the individual newsletters. The individual newsletters simply correspond to web pages. My newsletter and the Grasshopper newsletters in general, you take a web page, you send it in the mail. That's it. Very simple. So what we did in the Connectivism course is we set up something called The Daily. That was the name of the newsletter. I have no imagination when it comes to names. And The Daily went out to everybody in the course who was subscribed. Now, not everybody who signed up for the course subscribed to the newsletter. Nothing was mandatory in our course. But we had a consistent circulation of 1,870 people beginning to end in the course. There's the archives. The archives were very important. These are archives for my own newsletter, OL Daily. We had a similar archive set up for The Daily. It's just it wasn't as impressive as that because it was only a 3-month course. The idea was that a person could join the course late and by working through the archives actually catch up. And some people did that. Here are the pages that I talked about. Any given page in Grasshopper can become a newsletter. Or it can be just a web page, or it can be something that grabs content from the database. So it can be a list of presentations. You asked how I knew I had 217 presentations, because I have 217 presentations in there. There's the page editing, and again, I'm just going over something fairly briefly here. But the idea here is, and you can't see it, but there's code in there. That code in there grabs content from the database, organizes it, and presents that as the web page, which then becomes the newsletter. This is important because by grabbing content from the database, I can create pages, dynamic pages, by feeding information into the database. What I fed into the database was RSS feeds. What we did is we asked people in the course to create their own blog, their own wiki, their own whatever. We didn't care. Or to use a blog or a wiki or whatever that they already had, and to give us the address of their RSS feed. The other thing Grasshopper does is it aggregates these feeds. This is off my main site. Each of those is an RSS feed. Each RSS feed corresponds to somebody's individual blog. And the idea here is it pulls the content together and creates a web page out of it. So here's the harvester, and there's all kinds of ways of managing the harvest. And here's the screen that allows you to channel the input. A lot like Yahoo Pipes, I don't just take the content in and dump it. I take the content in, I interpret it, I assign topics to it, I can put it into individual tables, I can organize this content as it comes in from the RSS feeds. This is a viewer, and again, now I'm looking at the content that has been harvested as it sits on my site. And then the content that I've harvested, I can put into a post editor so I can add my own interpretation, my own comments. So I'm not just taking something and reproducing it. I'm taking something, working with it, and then sending it out. That's a very important component of this. And Grasshopper is free and open source software. So, we used that software in the course, the Grasshopper software. And we created, as I said, the daily. The daily became the lifeline for people in the course. Now, keep in mind, we've got stuff all over the place, and already all over the place. The wiki and so on and so forth. And so, this daily harvested all of this together and presented it in one place. So we organized the content. We harvested 170 separate feeds from participants in the course. Now that's not 2,200, but still 170 separate content feeds, I think, is very respectable. We made a list of those feeds available to people in something called OPML so that they could harvest it using their own reader if they wanted. They did not have to depend on us. And then we sent out the content. So we created videos in the course. The students created their own interpretation of the course. And in fact, the map that I showed you at the beginning was something that was actually created by the students. The students began now to take what we had put into place and make it their own. The students created other course maps. They created this, and then somebody created a video explaining how to add a pin to the map. This was very typical, where one person would do something, somebody else would build on it, and they were beginning to instruct each other. Another student created a Wordle out of the course. This is the Wordle on the first day. This is on the second day. This is on the third day. I think it would have been really neat if they had done it for 12 weeks, but they gave up after 3 days. It was quite fascinating. So the course spread, as I said, it wasn't advertised. It simply spread through word of mouth and our newsletters, and that was about it. Some students set up some Google groups, including the registered students, who were beginning to feel a little sort of underrepresented. And so they set up their own private Google group, which is great. This is what we wanted, right? We wanted people to organize themselves. People started translating. We had a lot of Spanish language translations of the course happen. And we had two separate Spanish language groups participating in the course. The Connectivitas, and I'm afraid I forget the name of the second one. I have a slide, I don't know what it is. It's just part of the course, but I never saw it. And so on. And here's what happened, right? 2,200 people, 170 blogs, all the stuff that George and I are doing, the links, the wiki, all of that. Nobody can read the whole thing. And we emphasized this, and we told people, nobody can read the whole thing. You can't, we can't. There is stuff that we as instructors will never see. There were three separate Second Life groups involved in this course. I visited one of them. But that is the way the course was deliberately structured. The idea here is you don't take this knowledge and assimilate it, right? There's this whole range of activities and people and connections and so on and so forth, and you get a perspective on it. You become a part of it. You interact with other people. You learn by having a point of view on this material and not by absorbing this material. And so that leads us to free learning, a model of learning where the learning is not an assimilation of facts, but rather a dialogue or a discussion that takes place in an authentic environment where people are trying to do, if you will, real things. And I know I'm basically running out of time, so I think I'll end it. There's a few more slides, there's about five more slides, but I'm not going to worry about that because I'd like to leave room for at least one question. So I'll end it here, and that's basically the theory of connectivism and the design of the course around connectivism.
the opportunity to ask questions, and I'll get Stephen to repeat the question because it's been EduStreamed, so people in our satellite campuses can listen to this talk. So, any questions?
The most striking thing that I took from your presentation was 2,200 people enrolled.
2,200.
And that being the numbers of people coming together is, to me, what would make a case study like this successful, and that there's more chance for conversations to take place with a large number of people. I'm not too sure how this would work with a smaller network.
Well, it would not. Yeah, the comment was that it works with a large number, it might not work as well with a small number. And I agree, wouldn't work as well with a small number. You don't want it to be a small number. It's the large number of participants that creates the dynamics, that creates the networks where you can have patterns of interaction, where you can have people from different perspectives and different points of view interacting with each other. So yeah, I wouldn't try this as a pilot project with 30 people. It would fail miserably. A pilot project with 3,000 people, much better. So I do think that the size is a key component of the design of the course. And that's one of the reasons why I think a model like this often has to go beyond the bound of your typical university class or your university environment.
Did you grade the students, and how on earth did the assessment work?
Okay, the only students that got graded were the 22 who signed up, plus the one student that was graded by their own institution. George did the grading. But I could easily have, it wouldn't have mattered. But I mean, again, it's 22 people. Now, in a full-blown instantiation of this, the grading wouldn't play a particular role. It wouldn't be part of the task of offering the course. I think that this model, as it rolls out over time, will be a model where the teaching is one thing, like the course is one thing, and the grading is something else. And that individuals from whatever institution may take part in the course, but be assessed according to their own home criteria, their own institution, their own company, whatever. We put the requirements up, right? We put what the assignments were so that we could see, and the rubrics as well for grading. So we made the assessment criteria very clear in the course. But I would expect that, over the long run, that assessment would take place locally rather than centrally. That would be my thinking on this. That would be neat if that happened. Are there signs of the community continuing? Yeah, and some of them are in this room. So they're definitely, and I need to be careful here, right? Because we didn't create a community, we created a network. The people who took part in the course, some of them were sort of members of the network before, more of them are members of the network after, but they are more or less closely or loosely associated with other people who are part of the course. And then there's a whole big part of it that I just can't see, like the whole, the Chobo community on Second Life or the Connectivitas. I know they're still talking to each other, but I just, that part of the network is just outside my purview. So I'd say the answer to your question is yes, but a qualified yes, because, it really changes form and shape. It's a very amorphous kind of thing.
Also, autonomous, which allows them to take it where they want.
Yeah, sorry, say that again?
Also, autonomous, which allows them to take it where they want.
That's exactly right, yeah. Autonomous, that allows them to take it where they want. The network, quite properly, we facilitated this, we set up the structure, but we are very deliberate about this. We were not creating a network, we were not creating a community. That was the job of the students. It was beyond our capacity to do, and beyond our rights to do. So we set up a structure, but we wanted them to create their network, and that's what they did. And then these things sort of spin off on their own. And that's what we wanted. Way in the back? That's a good question. I don't know. That was organized between George and the people at Illuminate. I believe that those seats are still there, but I think that you would have to work through the University of Manitoba to access them. Illuminate is the one part of this whole project that isn't really open software, and so it's the one part where we are most limited by licenses and access, and that's especially a factor after the end of the course. All the rest of the course is open and accessible, and you can still go in there now and look at it all and play in it. But the Illuminate part, you can only listen to the recordings at this point.
My interest in your lives, you have the differences between synchronous and asynchronous, and what kind of people do, what kind of learning, and for what reasons. And you talked about asynchronous and some of the people who try to take over the session.
Yeah.
You see that in the synchronous component, if you see different people from the synchronous component that are not participating in the asynchronous.
Yeah, the question was whether we saw people trying to take over the synchronous sessions the way we saw them trying to take over the threaded discussion list. And actually, at one point, I was accused of trying to take over the synchronous discussion. So I loved the irony of that, and of course I vehemently denied it. You know, I mean, it's like any synchronous discussion. Some voices were louder than others. Again, we had two separate kinds of synchronous discussion too. The Wednesday ones on Illuminate, we actually brought in guests. And I think because we brought in guests, and they were very respected guests, like who did we bring in? We brought in Nancy White. We brought in Valdis Krebs, who's an expert on networks. We brought in Harold Reingold. I'm trying to remember who all. And consequently, people were very respectful of that. And then the Friday session, because it was just the four of us on Skype, we didn't have the other people coming in, so they couldn't take over. So, yeah, you know, but I didn't feel the same, like with the discussion list, there was a deliberate, concerted effort to take it over and actually to sabotage the course, which I thought was very, odd. And we didn't see that kind of effort happen in the synchronous discussions.
What do you mean, sabotage the course?
Well, trolls, basically. People come in, attack the instructors, criticize anything and everything that anybody would write in the discussion area, that kind of thing. Because they felt that what we were offering, the theory that we were offering, was morally wrong. And it was, in fact, what they called, what did they call us? Techno-communists?
Techno-communists.
Yeah.
Just a very quick, that brings my question in about academic property, and how does that all fit into this?
Academic property?
That idea, yeah.
Well, yeah.
I know it's a big topic.
Well, it's a big topic. Like, we got past most of the difficulties there by not trying to take stuff and put it in the course. Worse, we left stuff sitting where it was, and we linked to it. And when you link to an article, you don't run into problems of copyright and things like that, because you're linking to somebody else's article that they've posted online. Similarly with the student contributions, right? They contributed in their space, on their blog, except for in the discussion area, right? And you know, with the discussion area, the threaded discussion list, then you do run into those sorts of issues. But we wanted people to contribute by participating on their own space, so those sort of issues don't arise, that people own their own content and have the right to remove it, change it, whatever, and we don't need to worry about that.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I'm just wondering about, like, for instance, your leading and letting people, you know, access your material.
Mm-hmm.
Have you found that it's, you know, been a bad experience, that people have misrepresented, misunderstood you and misquoted you?
Yeah, but I don't worry about that.
Yeah.
Well, because, you know, I could express myself perfectly and people would misrepresent me. That's just, it's a fact of life. You know, and it's impossible to exercise control over this. And so I think that really it's wasted effort to try to exercise control over this, especially in an era where communications are cheap and very easy and you know, pervasive. So I don't worry about being misrepresented. And you know, the other side of it too is, if somebody searches for me online, they generally find me and not somebody misrepresenting me. And that is created only by being open with my work. If I tried to be closed with my work, then somebody searching for me would be more likely to find one of my critics.
Okay, well, on that note, we will bring this to a close, and I'd just like to thank Stephen for your efforts today, and it's been really interesting to find out not only about connectivism, but a whole lot of new technologies that many of us would never have even known about, and the way that we all can exist within a network. So thank you very much.